Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the source of the connection between animals and humans, and are there lessons to be learned from the ways animals relate to us and to the world? When Vintberger was just a few years out of veterinary school, he discovered that a badly injured dog began to improve when he was nearby to provide company, comfort, and gentle touches. That realization shifted the direction of Virgo's research interest to animal behavioral medicine, and more than 20 years later, he believes that paying close attention to the ways that animals relate to the world can help people live better lives, too. The new book by Dr. Vintverga is called The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. And we are getting him on the line right this minute, so we will have him on the phone there. Vint, hi, welcome to Think.
Hi, nice to be here.
So wonderful to have you. Can you start by telling us about this amazing epiphany that you had in caring for a retriever named Pongo?
Sure. It was very early on in my stage, my career as a vet. I was 4 years out of vet school. At the time, I was working in an emergency practice in Eugene, Oregon. And as it was typical, maybe in a November night, we were deluged with clients, and it was at the height of the first wave of patients that we discovered that this dog was being rushed into the treatment room named Pongo. He was a young, healthy, rather sizable flat-coated retriever, and he'd been hit by a pickup that was driving by his home. And Pongo presented to me in critical condition. He was rushed by his owners straight back into the treatment room, which usually means that it's pretty serious, past all the other patients that were waiting in the treatment room, in the exam room. I'm sorry, in the reception room.
Right.
And when I took a look at Pongo, besides seeing that he was in shock and definitely considering not being around on the earth much longer, I couldn't find anything in his body at all that seemed to indicate why he would be in such horrible condition. All of his lab work came back unremarkable. His x-rays came back unremarkable. And his physical exam really didn't show me anything particularly unusual. And what I discovered was that there really was nothing that we could do except intensive supportive care and let time take its course, which sometimes happens with patients.
Mm-hmm.
So while I checked in on him several times during the night, it wasn't until much later in the evening, actually early morning, about 2 or 3 in the morning, when all the other clients were either settled into their runs or cages or gone back home with their families, that I was able to finally spend more time with Pongo. At that time of the night, I was exhausted, and what I found myself sitting next to was a dog, if anything, that was in worse condition than when he came into the clinic. And as I sat there trying to rack my brain as to what I could do for him, I also worked on my other medical records from the evening. What happened is, over the course of an hour, as I lay on the ground next to Pongo working on my records with one hand, I was petting him and trying to comfort him and just be with him. And I noticed with my other hand that over time he started to actually respond from a dog that was not paying attention or even aware of what was going on to a dog that was sniffing my hand, licking at my arm, nudging to get closer into my lap. There was nothing I had done for him in that last magical hour in the middle of the night except just to be with him. And that was really the transformational moment in my career as a vet, realizing that aside from all the science and medical texts and everything else that we do, sometimes the most important thing we do is nothing more than just sharing our attention, love, and comfort with each other.
So I know that you're aware of this, and I don't bring this up to be disrespectful. There are people who think of behavioral medicine for animals as a sort of luxury specialty. Can you talk about what you think maybe they misunderstand about the goal of what you do?
Well, I think I would agree with you that I think that the general perception of behavioral medicine is a luxury. But what I can tell you is for the families that have sought help and come to me for advice. From the speaking with the keepers at zoos, the curators at zoos that I work with now on a regular basis, where we aren't even talking about families and their pets. The animals that I'm working with have definite emotional needs that are, if not identical, very, very, very closely intimate with our human wants and emotions and needs. And I think the perception that animals are, that behavioral medicine is a luxury comes from this perception that animals maybe perhaps don't experience emotions, don't have the type of self-awareness that we do as human beings, which in almost 30 years of practice now I would strongly disagree with.
And you know, it's funny, there's that perception that animals don't have emotions or nothing that would remotely compare with us. And then there is the fact that surveys reveal that most people who have pets believe that they have the capacity to understand us.
Oh, yes, and isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
More than 2 out of 3 American households have an animal. Usually, most of the time, it's a dog or cat, but it can be anything from an iguana to a horse that's just outside their door. And by far and large, the majority of families feel like their animals respond to their emotions. They respond to their animals' emotions, that our animals have similar self-identity, self-awareness, personalities that are very, very distinct. I don't think there's very many animal owners out there, if any, that would say, oh, this dog has doesn't have a very different personality from the last dog I had. Hmm. Our animals are individuals. The animals I see in zoos, the animals I see in nature, each animal has an individual identity, an individual spirit, and by far and large, 94% plus of animal owners that live with a dog or cat or other animal companion feel that their animals are very attendant to their emotional needs and are in tune with people. They also, and the people, are just as well in tune with them.
You remind us here that expressing our love for an animal in our care requires us to be sensitive, not just to how much we want to pet them or hug them or kiss them, but to be sensitive to how they will perceive those affections. You have this great story that, you know, sometimes that means giving the family cat a place to enjoy company without too many hugs from a preschooler who really loves that cat.
Yes. Well, that's really one of my, I think, one of my primary, I guess, focuses in practice, whether it's at the zoo or whether it's with families with pets in their homes. Because we tend to be anthropomorphic, because we limit our experience, we're limited in our experience to what we see, smell, hear. We think that our animal's perception of the world is the same as ours is. And yet, if you think about it, it's not a reach at all for anybody that's lived with a dog or a cat to realize they hear things that we don't hear. They smell things that we certainly don't smell, or certainly well in advance before we do. Mm-hmm. Their senses are tuned differently than us, sometimes more sensitively. Sometimes they just pick up on different parts of the spectrum of everything that's out there in the world. And as such, it's presumptuous, I think, of us as humans to think, oh, well, they have a different maybe place in the world from which they view the world, but basically they view it the same as us, and that simply isn't true. So that's really one of the main driving passions behind my work, is to help people to understand, well, what do our dogs really think about? What are our cats really perceiving right now? And it's really, really different a lot of times than what we believe it is.
You know, I have a dog and she's very tiny and she's always cold in the winter. And forever we kept trying to put a blanket on her and she would always shake it off. What she wants is to sit next to somebody's thigh, which is nice and warm. She doesn't want a blanket.
Yes, so there's a perfect example of how we would comfort ourselves with a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
But to a dog, that might not be what they want. Now, there may be dogs that absolutely love snuggling under the blanket, but that's the other trap we fall into, is we make generalizations.
Yeah.
And it's very common for people to ask me, what is my dog doing or thinking when she's doing that? Or why does my cat do this? And my answer almost always is, well, it depends. What else is going on right now? We've got to look at context and situations. We behave differently from circumstance to circumstance. We behave differently at home than at work. And the reasons why our dogs, cats, horses, the animals in the zoo do different behaviors can vary depending upon what else is going on in the world.
So tell us how to think a little bit like you think. And what does it take to open our eyes and our ears and our noses and try to perceive things from the perspective of our dog or cat or bird or, I hesitate to say fish, but fish, whatever animal we have?
Well, that's a wonderful question. So what it requires, I think, first of all, is a willingness to say we're all beginners.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be the first to say, after all the years I've been working with animals, I'm still probably the first person in any group that would sit back and say, well, let's just watch and see and try to figure this out. I don't feel like I have the answers. I don't feel like anyone does. So the beginning is to be willing to say, I don't really know. Let's see what we can figure out. And then it's a matter of patience, watching, and noticing. Behavioral medicine itself is a very interesting science in that it like all medicine, there's a science part and an art part. And a huge part of the science part is, quite honestly, with behavior, because we can't get into our brains. You can't do an MRI or a CT scan and say, this is what an animal's thinking, mm-hmm. this is what a person's thinking. You can say, this happens when they're imagining this, this happens when they're experiencing this. But we don't really know what a person or an animal is thinking unless they volunteer that information to us. So with behavioral medicine, with you, your friends, the first step is to say, okay, well, what could be going on? Okay, if it were this, then if I were to do this, what would they do in response? And with behavior, we make plenty of assessments and then reassessments and reassessments. So what it looks like is coming home and instead of saying, oh, well, my dog feels guilty because she's coming up, sidling up next to me, and what I see is the cushions on the sofa or the pillow on the sofa has been torn to
shredded, right.
So obviously my dog's feeling guilty. In true terms, what we could say a little more objectively is to say that our dog's showing us signals that she gets something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is she really doing here? And if we look then at the with a little bit more information and watching her, our dogs, if we forgive them and start acting entirely normally in that situation with the sofa, and we were to say, for example, oh, you silly ninny, I don't care about those cushions. Come and play with me.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. We will continue this thought. My guest is veterinarian Vint Verga. His new book is called The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Vint Verga. He is a veterinarian who specializes in behavioral medicine. He's also author of the new book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Vint, before the break, we were talking about ways to respond appropriately and sensitively to that very distressing shredded cushion our dog presents us with when we come home from work.
Sure. So if our dogs, if we come home and our cats are acting on what we would interpret them to be guilty because they've peed outside the litter box, or our dogs have torn up the cushions on the sofa, what they are really doing is they're actually not acting in guilt. And I think where I was going with the story is, if we could go out and play with them or immediately start doing another activity, if they were truly feeling guilty, they would be continuing to show those regretful behaviors even long after the play. And in fact, what our animals will do is immediately join us and move on. And what our dog is doing in that situation, or our kitty cat, is they're saying to us, I get you're upset. Possibly even I upset you. What can we do to move past this? Which I think has beautiful lessons for us. Okay, it's happened. So what are we going to do about it? And how do we get through to what's most, how do we get past to what's most important? To them, what's most important is the relationship with us and moving on and being happy.
So I want to talk about animal communication, because when we humans communicate, first and foremost, we go to language, right? There's written language, there's verbal language. Of course, we have body language and other cues, but we don't necessarily think about those first. And yet, having an animal in our lives maybe takes the focus off vocalization. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, it is funny, though. It is our nature as humans to focus on words. I, as much as everybody, especially, I laugh at the number of times I sit there and think about the particular words to choose when I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet so much of our communication is nonverbal. There's been plenty of scientific studies out there that show that the minute we walk into a room, we make instant impressions about people within seconds before a word has even been uttered. We pick up on a lot of the cues that animals do, odors that we don't even perhaps even recognize, sounds, smells that don't maybe, that are filtered out before they actually reach our conscious attention. And yet we pick up on those signals. Not to say that we don't have intuition and that we feel intuitive hits, but a lot of what we dismiss as being, oh, it's just a feeling, is actually us picking up on cues that we think are insignificant as humans, or we don't even recognize we're picking up on. So where I think that animals offer us a beautiful lesson in communication is that their focus, of course, is not on words, but on the spectrum of other signals that are out there in the world. Everything from pheromones to nonverbal sounds. The rate of breathing, gulping in between sentences, expressions, postures, the little even the way in which we connect with each other, how long we glance in each other's eyes before we look away, what direction we look, all have very important all bear very important information to us. And I think if we take the time to realize, you know what, there's a lot more going on than just paying attention to our words, we can start to notice that other people are signaling to us non-verbally a lot of times what they're focusing on, what they're interested in, and our animals can do the same.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Scott in Arlington. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Chris. Great show.
Thank
it
you.
Makes me feel guilty for being an omnivore. But I do say, I always understood the human brain as being the brain of a mammal, and the mammals have the full range of emotions, at least from what I understood. We just have that extra layer of language on top. And do you make that distinction between the mammal brain having a full range, or what we understand as a full range of emotions, and our pets, like you said, iguanas and fish, Do you make that distinction, that the mammalian, I guess, is that the term, the mammalian brain versus the other animals outside of that kingdom?
Well, I certainly do make a distinction, and yet I don't think that there is a dividing line between human and animal, and we can say this is human, this is animal, and in fact, all the evidence out there shows that there's a whole spectrum from what you would find in human beings to what you would find in what we might call a lesser organism. But the more and more research and more evidence that comes in from what we would call objective scientific peer-reviewed studies, over the decades, if we look at it, more and more information seems to show us, you know what? We're not giving them as much credit as we should be. So when I say there's a spectrum, certainly there's a difference between a dolphin's brain and a chimpanzee's brain than there is from a possum's or a chipmunk's brain. But to say that there's a dividing line, a distinction between this is human, this is a cetacean, this is musculine, is where I think we show our human bias. We want to create this distinction between us and the rest of the animal beings in the world, because we don't want to perceive ourselves as animals. And if we go in just a very, very simple classification, well, you're either an animal or you're a plant or you're non-living. You know, human beings are animals, but obviously we're much more evolved. Of course, with that evolution, we also carry a lot of extra baggage too.
Well, I guess it's so important also to put animal behaviors in context and to the extent that we relate them to our own behaviors. You write about the fact that, looking in more careful, contextual ways at behavior of animals like wolves helps us to understand that, for example, they're not wantonly aggressive, and in fact, they can be pretty cooperative. But we didn't understand that until quite recently.
No, and I think that there is a beautiful example of our human bias in action. So it was back in, I could be wrong on this, it may have been the 40s, but I want to say it was back around in the 50s that that researchers came up with this theory studying wolves in captive situations. So these are not free-ranging wolves, where they were trying to figure out their relationship within a pack. And what they said is, okay, well, this wolf is basically the top wolf. He's the alpha. Okay, now this wolf's the omega, and there's the beta, and so forth. And what we were trying to do, what they were doing really, is they were looking at impaired interactions, which isn't the way nature works, even in a captive wolf pack. If you just put two wolves together in a contest for any specific resource, who wins in that contest? And so that became by the nature of the study, they basically developed a hierarchical organization to what they thought how a wolf pack was organized. But the key researchers that did that research came back decades later and said, you know what, this is a lot of what's been taken and put into the mainstream media is a misperception of what we were talking about or a misinterpretation. But more importantly, wolves don't live that way. If you look at wolves in nature, they live in packs. It's true, there's leaders. The leaders tend to be a male and a female, and the other ones tend to be, guess what, extended family. They're much more like our human families than we ever recognized before then. They don't lead by assertion, excuse me, in domination. They lead by guidance. And sometimes there's a little bit of correction that needs to take place, but the alpha wolf is not the wolf that dominates all the others and is the boss. And in fact, everything's contextual in a wolf pack.
So obviously an insight like that, Vint, is something that in your work with animals who are ordinarily wild, who are living in captivity, when you're dealing with animals in zoos, I mean, a lot of people are now starting to question whether zoos are the best way for us to honor animals. We want to see them. But can you talk about how you balance that and how you have to be aware that even the very best zoo is a less than natural environment for an animal?
Oh, yes. And it's such a struggle. It's something I deal with on a day-to-day basis. I used to avoid zoos with a passion when I was younger, all the way into early into my veterinary career, just because it really just was too difficult for me to see animals in captivity situations. But at some point, I made a decision in my career, you know what? Escaping and avoiding and denying that they exist isn't really solving anything. And what I'd be a lot better doing if it really upsets me that much is to work within the system. And that's when I started doing, turning my focus towards zoo work. Zoos in the past 30 years have evolved hugely, maybe even I would say 40 years. So what used to be the main primary purpose of a zoo back in the 50s and 60s, and certainly well before then, centuries before then, was primarily for display and entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
The animals were basically confined to cages, pens, for people to get a good close look at them. The vast majority of zoos nowadays, at least in North America and certainly in many other parts of the world, are evolving and have been evolving for probably since about the late 70s, the dawning of the Aquarian Age. And what zoos started taking on as their primary mission was educating people instead of entertaining them about animals. As we see more and more animals becoming endangered, their other main mission besides education has been towards conservation. And it's undeniable that there are many species out there that we see at zoos, endangered species, that would not be around or would be almost extinct were it not for zoos. With those two primary purposes of education and conservation, what zoos have now taken on as their primary mission, almost every zoo out there that I've ever worked with what they have done is evolve how they handle animals. So they are now in the process of changing from what would have been before a display to exhibits. Or now, instead of exhibits, really what we try to think of them as is habitats. They aren't habitats that are natural, but we try to do the best we can.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking with veterinarian Dr. Vint Verga. If you'd like to join us, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Autumn in Dallas. Hello, Autumn.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. My question for Dr. Verga is the topic of house training for dogs and potty training for people, and I don't know if it's as traumatic for dogs as it is for people, or if it is considered traumatic, but I'm wondering how I'm trying to house train. I have two dogs, one of my dogs, and right when I think we're over the hump and she's not going to go to the bathroom in the house anymore, she surprises me by going on my bed. And I don't know, are they communicating that they're angry with us or what, or if there's any correlation between the experience of house training and with animals or potty training in adults. Is it considered a milestone? Do they notice it? Do they not care? Does it not mean that much to them?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand the question. So are we talking specifically about house training in adult animals, or are we also talking about puppies when they're very
young? In this case, it's an adult dog. It's a two-year-old dog that when I got her at 9 months, I was told that she was house trained, but she actually wasn't. And she sleeps in a crate at night with the other dog and never goes in the crate. But when I'm trying to have them loose in the house more because they're in and out side, and I try to watch her when she comes in, and when I think I see her, she's about to go, I run her outside, and I get her to go outside. And also, if she's been inside for a few minutes, I'll run her outside, and I'll ask her to go, and she'll go, and then we'll go back in. So I'm thinking, you know, I do this regularly that I have it down, and then this morning she'll come in and she wasn't in more than a minute and she went on my bed.
Okay. So, well, I certainly can't give an accurate behavioral diagnosis over the telephone or even in the course of an hour conversation. It usually involves me seeing an animal and being with them for a little bit and talking with their family members to understand exactly what's going on. What I can tell you is that if we're talking about an adult dog, certainly there's going to be individuals. There's going to be dogs belonging to some breeds that are going to be quicker or a little bit slower to learn about what our human preferences are in terms of their soiling habits. It's very common, I find, for people to tell me that my dog or my cat is peeing or pooping somewhere on purpose. They're doing it because they're mad at me, and they're telling me so. And I think that that's entirely, well, I think that's entirely possible. What I will tell you is that people tell me that a lot more often than I actually find that to be the case that's actually happening. So what becomes involved? What else could be going on besides the dog telling us, well, I'm just mad at you because you're not getting it? Our dogs can develop preferences that we're entirely clueless about. Remember, or clueless of. Think of the conversation we were having a few minutes ago about the senses and the spectrum of different cues and signals that animals pick up on that we don't. There can be circumstances in the yard. There can be plants, substrates, or how things look, smell, feel. There can be the disturbances of something as silly as a gopher in a hole digging in the ground, a distant dog in another backyard, or the neighbor's cat that we didn't even notice that's sitting on the fence line, that's staring down our dog that's sitting in our yard. And so our dogs can be picking up on things that we're oblivious to as humans. And so what I generally say is that most likely what's going on is your dog is signaling to you that something is not great about their current situation of where they're eliminating, or that they have a preference for, well, you know, I don't get it. I don't get what you're wanting. This is just as good to me as anywhere else. And in that case, what's going on is we're having a miscommunication between what we're expecting and what we'd like.
Gotta jump in here to take a break. My guest is Vint Verga, author of the new book, The Soul of All Living Creatures. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Vint Verga. He's a veterinarian who specializes in behavioral medicine for animals, and he's author of the new book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Vint, you were talking to Autumn before the break. It sounds like she might need to just do a little bit more detective work and find out what could be standing in the way of her adult dog being house trained.
Yes, but the detective work can be so fun in and of itself. I think that's what I enjoy so much about working with animals, is trying to figure out, well, what are they thinking and feeling? Why is this happening? Why isn't it happening the way we want it to?
You talk about integrity in animals, which I think is a fascinating concept, because, again, this is something that we associate with ourselves. We feel separate from all the other animals on the planet. But, in fact, it may very well, the integrity in humans may have its roots in our distant evolutionary past.
Yes, well, I use a little different term. I look at integrity a little bit differently than what we would consider to be a standard textbook definition. I mean, to be integrous means that we follow our highest values and what we think is most important. But if we even step back and look at it from a little bit broader perspective, what we're saying is that for an animal or a person to be integrous, they're honoring every part of them. They're paying attention to what's most important, and they're not dismissing secondary voices, intuitions, feelings, or parts of their behavior. So when I say when I look at human integrity or animal integrity, what I'm looking at is how balanced is their life? Are they getting to express all of their range of behaviors? Are they finding fulfillment in every avenue of their life? With a person, with my own life, as I do that, what I look at is not only my health and my physical well-being, but I look at my family and my relationships with my wife, my daughter, my animals, the keepers I work with at the zoos, my clients and patients, and then on to the other things that I value most, my time for creativity or writing, my sense of feeling connected spiritually with others in the world. It varies for each individual person what their highest values are, but integrity is a matter of living with it where we're honoring each one of those values. With our animals, the same thing applies. If we just pay attention to our dogs' and cats' well-being with respect to food and taking them for walks, then we aren't thinking about the rest of what they do in their days. You know, what do they have to think about? What do they have to do? They don't watch television. They don't read. So what we try to do within thinking about animal integrity is think about their whole behavioral repertoire and what we can do to make their lives richer and fuller, just like we would do with ourselves.
Animals in our lives can also remind us of the beauties of really living in the moment and being fully present.
Yes. We, I think, as humans, with the very first call we had in on the show today, we were talking about, well, what is the difference between the human brain and the mammalian brain or the lesser animal brain? And I think what we do with our higher powers of communication that we have as human and our ability to analyze and oftentimes overthink is that we take ourselves right out of the moment. I can't tell you the number of times driving from one place to another, I find myself suddenly going, where was my mind? And I miss the flock of geese that's flying overhead. I miss the smells of the rain that's coming over the pavement because my windows are rolled up and the air conditioner's on. I miss the story that my daughter was just telling me as she's riding in the back seat of my car, and suddenly I hear the last few sentences of the story. We spend so much time in our brains as humans, and I think that animals, because of their presence in the moment, by the nature of who they are as beings, can serve as constant reminders. Oh yeah, here I am right now, and I'm not back in that. Dinner that I just had last night where it felt so uncomfortable with my friend and we were having that heated discussion. I'm not in that review with my boss tomorrow. I'm here right now with my daughter on the freeway and she's telling me a wonderful story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Sonia in Plano. Hello, Sonia.
Hello. I wanted to get the doctor's opinion on if he thinks that dogs do not have a sense of time. I have a standing disagreement with my husband about it. And, you know, for example, can he tell the difference between me being gone 30 minutes as opposed to 5 hours? And, you know, when I leave at work in the morning, the dog barks at me, he's mad at me. When I come home, he kisses me. So what is the opinion of the sense of time?
I love that question. Wonderful question. I have no doubt in my mind that our dogs, our cats, most animals I work with in the zoo world have a very strong sense of time. They know about their routines. They know about time of day. And because of their senses and their focus, they're actually more in tune with it than we are. Here's a wonderful example. Back when I was a veterinary student at UC Davis, back in the the 80s, I hate to say. Back then, dogs were actually allowed in our vet student classrooms. And way before we would, if we ever had a lecture that wasn't just a typical hour, a lot of times we'd have an hour and a half lecture, 2 hours out of the norm, the dogs that were in the lecture hall would all be signaling to the vet students, hey, you know, wait a minute. What's going on here? We're supposed to be taking a break right now and going on to another class. So the dogs would start getting fidgety and nervous 5 minutes before the supposed break time, and they would understand, hey, this is what the clock's saying, but they didn't pay attention to the clock. Part of my life and trying to be in tune with animals is where I need to, I wear a watch. When I absolutely have to, like to catch a plane flight, I'll set an alarm clock. But I live most of my life without paying attention to clocks as much as possible. And it's amazing how if we go through that exercise for a few days, we start becoming very much in tune with time. Our dogs are just as much in tune, even more so than we are, because we forget about that intuitive nature we have. Our dogs don't do that.
I want to talk about the things you've written here about what we can learn about adaptability from animals. And you point out that we humans, we think of adaptation in terms very often of how other people should adapt to our needs, and we don't necessarily turn that around the other way.
Absolutely. I think it's that whole alpha mentality that we have as humans, that we've got to dominate and the world is our dominion and we've got to control situations, even if it's just the circumstances where we don't like what's going on. So I check into the hotel this morning that I'm at in Chicago, and it's fun just to watch while I'm waiting to get my room key and being attended to look at the other people, and if someone else isn't getting the room upgrade they want, or someone else has an extra something on the bill that wasn't supposed to be there. It's so funny how we tend to try to control things right away by manipulating the circumstances instead of stepping back just a moment and going, well, what's going on here? What we tend to do as human beings is we tend to react, I think, a lot more than animals do. Not to say that animals aren't reactionary. Of course they are. We all are. But what animals do tend to do is that they tend to accept the world as it is and then adapt accordingly and move on and say, okay, well, what do we need to do about this? We as humans, I think, try to clench down and try to control situations a lot more than we need to.
So I guess that would also, in terms of adaptability and the way that animals are paying attention to the cues that we give them, a routine is really important for us to provide to them, so that, as in your class, they sort of know, they know when the break is coming. They know when you're going to be home from work and let them out and give them something to eat.
Yeah, routine's important, but they'll be the first ones to tell us that if we're off routine, they know, hey, what's going on here?
Right.
What are you doing wrong here? My cats have reminded me plenty of times when I'm lost at my desk in thought and writing, hey, you know what? It's getting late, and it's time to go pick up my daughter at school.
Do you think people, Vin, are more open to the idea that animals have a full range of emotions than they were even when you started practicing as a veterinarian?
I do. I started practicing as a vet in the 80s now, so times have changed. I think I honestly think what's happened more so, though, in the past 30 years is that people have been more willing to share their opinions and their experience with animals, and to realize, you know what, I'm not alone. What I thought about my dogs having these feelings, my cats having these emotions, I'm not the only one that believes that. And so there's been a lot more sharing going on, a lot more conversation. I actually think long ago, the old-time farmers, that way before we got into such a highly developed society as we do have now, also recognize that. They were very in tune with their animals. And I think that I think that's just been an evolution of our awareness as human beings.
That's an interesting point when you talk about farmers and people raising animals either to do work or even for food purposes. They can't simply treat those things like objects because it would affect their livelihood. They would have to sort of know those animals intimately, particularly beasts of burden that they would be working with every day.
Sure, and I think that modern times have shown that, where certainly as with growing populations, factory farming became much more popular and prevalent in our society. And then we started seeing the problems with that in terms of animal welfare, but also in terms of the consequences, everything from infectious diseases, because the animals are more stressed and not being fulfilled in their environment, whatever it is, before they have to end up as food, to just their day-to-day work with us, whether we're talking about even a field dog or a sporting dog running through the field with us. So I think that our awareness as humans, as we become more in tune with animals, helps us to understand not only more about them, but more about our own human nature.
What lessons can we take from animals about forgiveness?
Oh, wow. The animals I work with on a day-to-day basis, while they certainly experience unpleasant circumstances, both physically and emotionally, I think overall they handle them with a lot more grace than I see other human beings or even myself doing. We tend to, because we tend to dwell on past injuries, because we tend to worry so much about future circumstances and how, whether we're going to feel safe, comfortable, whether we're going to be cared for when we're meeting with these people or being put in some awkward circumstance. We overanalyze things, and animals that I work with, I find are able to move past those unfortunate circumstances a lot more smoothly and with a lot more grace and poise than most human beings. And I certainly want to say that isn't a universal phenomenon. There are plenty of animals I work with more intensively as patients that are having trouble letting go of past injuries. They certainly can go through painful ordeals where they don't forget an unfortunate circumstance. And then what I find is we need to help them, but they're experiencing, what I find those animals are doing is oftentimes acting a lot more like we are as human beings. That's not really the norm. I think that animals overall, especially the animals I deal with in the zoos, move past their unfortunate circumstances a lot more smoothly and gracefully than we do.
Do you find it easier to work with animals who are very attuned to having humans around? I'm guessing if there's a problem with like a big cat, you're not getting in the enclosure with that animal. You're observing from a distance.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that question.
Is it easier for you to, and we just have a few seconds left here, but is it easier for you to work with animals who are accustomed to having humans around and interacting with them all the time?
Sure, of course it is. But all the animals I'm working with, if you think about it at the zoos, they're an incredible team of dedicated keepers and curators that their entire job, their focus of their career is the welfare and benefit of those animals and the health and well-being of those animals. If we could all have someone that was focused on us with that amount of attention, just think of what our lives would be like.
Hmm. Vint Verga is a veterinarian specializing in behavioral medicine. His new book is called The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. Vint, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It has been wonderful.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and Christine McConnell produced the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.